I would like to thank Lucien for inviting me to give this colloquium and all the PI for the opportunity to visit this fantastic place and to lecture at the PSI program. And today I will be discussing, present some work I've been doing on the relation between the phenomena of quantum decoherence in spin system and some mathematics of random matrix models. So it will be, in fact, some kind of elementary talk about trying to get as much as possible from a toy model. I won't be discussing decoherence in real physical spin systems or the kind of quantum systems that are studied in laboratories, in particular, for instance, nearby, I presume, at the Quantum Information Center. But it will be something much more basic. But I hope you will see that it's this kind of studying this kind of models, very simplified model, is still interesting because in some cases, using, for instance, random matrix techniques, you can go much further than what people are able to do in real experiments. You know, so probe theoretically some fine effects which are not so trivial. So what is decoherence? So I presume that most of you here, at least all the senior people and some of the students, have already heard about what is quantum decoherence. And quantum decoherence is simply one of the most basic and important features of quantum theory, because it means that if you have a quantum system with some degrees of freedom and some states, in fact, the quantum correlation between some of the states, in fact, are very, very difficult to observe. They disappear very quickly. You cannot observe them. They are there in the whole universe, we believe, but simply because the system, this quantum system here, is coupled to another big systems, and therefore the correlation becomes lost, you know, in the whole big system. So in fact, decoherence as a rule, in fact, also the term was, I think, coined in the 70s by Z. It's a feature of quantum theory which was known before. And I think that even in the first paper, we discussed the question of measurement in quantum mechanics, and we were people like John von Neumann or Mott discussed the coupling, what's happening when you have a quantum system which interacts with some measurement device. They already had discussing in some very implicit way what was taking place, which was decoherence. But decoherence, in fact, got very much discussed, in particular by Zurek and all the school in Los Alamos, where people started to discuss what is happening when you have a quantum system, you have its measurement device, for instance, but it's coupled to very big systems, which is usually very weakly coupled to the quantum system, which is the rest of the universe, so it's the environment or some of the degrees of freedom. So there are many, many different kind of basic systems where decoherence is important. For instance, you have this system, you have a quantum system, you have the measurement device, but you have to take into account the coupling with the environment, which interacts both with the quantum system and to the measurement device. Another example is when you have a quantum system, what is called a probe, which is another less quantum system, and the measurement device, and that's something which is met, in fact, in many, many actual experiments, when one is performing what is called an indirect measurement of a quantum system, because, for instance, in cold atoms, when they measure the state of a cavity where there is some electromagnetic field, they send atoms through the cavity. The atom is considered as a probe which interacts with the quantum system with an electromagnetic field in a cavity, and then it is the atom which is observed by some measurement. You know, so the state of the atom is destroyed, but the interest of that kind of system is that you don't destroy the quantum system during your act of measurements, but decoherence takes place. Of course, when you are asking whether why don't I observe the moon both here and here, while in quantum mechanics, it can be in a superposition state of the moon be there and the moon be there, you have to take account the interaction between the quantum system, which is the moon, and the environment, which is, for instance, the field of all the photons which lives in the solar system and which like the moon. And more generally, in fact, everything can be put in the framework that if you have a big quantum system, usually some of the degrees of freedom are macroscopic degrees of freedom, which behaves like the classical degrees of freedom of the systems we have access to. But the system has many, many microscopic quantum degrees of freedom, and you can consider the macroscopic classical degrees of freedom as the quantum system you are considering, and the rest as the environment or the system. Okay. So everywhere you have to take into account the effects of decoherence. So that, but decoherence, as I will consider it, is a dynamical question. The dynamical question is that you have a quantum system with a set of states. Then you have your external system E with another, usually bigger state of systems. And decoherence is simply the following very well-known fact, is that if you start from what is called the separable state, where your system S is in a superposition of two quantum states, and your external system is in another state, but it is separable, this separable state evolves usually into an entangled state, where the system has evolved here in another state, but the external system has evolved into a state phi 1 or phi 2, which depend on in which state the small system was. And so this is a separable state. This is an entangled state, which means that if you observe now just the system S, you have lost the quantum correlation. You can never observe the quantum correlation from the original states simply by observing the small systems after it has evolved with the system. So basically, this is decoherence, and the question is, how does this occur? So decoherence is a quantum phenomenon. It's a consequence of entanglement and the law of evolution, of unitary evolution of quantum mechanics. It's a basic aspect of irreversibility in open quantum system, and in some sense, it can be viewed as a loss of quantum coherence, exactly like dissipation. If you have a system which interacts with some other systems, it dissipates energy because it's lost its energy by coupling with the other systems. And it's an old concept, but it had to wait the development of quantum open system theory to be considered seriously in the 70s. And it's, of course, now a mature theoretical and experimental subject, which is very, very important in quantum information, in experiments about quantum systems like cold atoms, ions, in quantronic electronic system, in quantum dots, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So, what I want to present is a simple theoretical model where I will consider that the quantum system is just a quantum spin, and the interaction with the external system is described by random matrices. Why such a model? Because decoherence is now, I think, quite well understood, where you have no or very small called quantum memory effect. If you assume that the evolution in the evolution of the system is coupled to the external systems, you can forget very quickly that the memory, the non-local in time effect, then everything contained in the evolution of the density matrix for the small systems. And in that case, if you can neglect the quantum memory effect, it is very well known that the evolution of the density matrix can be written as a master equation which is local in time, namely the derivative of the density matrix is just a linear operator. It's a linear operation acting on the density. And there is a linear operator which is independent on time. And usually, well-known mathematical theorem states that this L can be put in the form of so-called Lindblad operator. So this Lindblad operator is just, there is a part which is an effective Hamiltonian dynamics, which reproduces the unitary dynamics of quantum mechanics. But then you have, in general, other terms, which are, if you want, dissipative terms, which represent the fact that the dynamics of the evolution is, in general, irreversible. But this is true only if the evolution neglects the non-locality in time of quantum mechanics, which occurs. Of course, quantum mechanics evolution for a closed system is local in time, but if you couple it into an external system and forget about the external system, then the evolution becomes non-local in time. Okay? And so, in general, you need approximation in order to understand what's going on in those systems. Now, why do I choose to study a quantum spin? It's because it's one of the simplest examples of a quantum system, where in general you have a spin G, which is a quantum spin, because it is very well known, you found this in any textbook in quantum mechanics, that when the spin is very, very large, a quantum spin behaves like a classical top. And so we know very well, where if you study the dynamics of a quantum spin, whatever, even if the dynamics is very complicated, we expect that the classical limit of the spin, which should emerge in some dynamical regime, would be that of a classical top. So it's a very simple toy model. Okay, but also it's related to experimental systems. For instance, some people are doing very nice experiments of ferromagnetic nanoparticles, which are composed of a few hundreds or a few thousands atoms, which have each their own, or molecules which have each their own little quantum spin. And in those models, this represents a way to represent a study, a large spins, which come out for a really quantum system. Also, many theoretical models of measurement apparatus are, in fact, uses the fact that they take a spin and they consider a quantum spin, which have a tendency to align, for instance, to the spin of the photons which comes into the apparatus or of the qubit. So they are used in the theory of the measurement. And spin system, in fact, such spin system, have been studied since a long time in condensed matter. For instance, one of the first papers was by Takahashi and Shibata in 1975, where they started to study the dissipation in quantum spin systems already at that time. Okay, so why do I choose random matrices? That's because in general, when you have a quantum system, it may have a very complicated quantum dynamics, and quantum dynamics is known to be well described in many cases by assuming that the Hamiltonian of the system is a random Hamiltonian. And the most seminal example is the example of Eugene Wigner, who suggested in 55 that the spectra of some heavy nuclei could be described just by taking a random Hamiltonian. And the basic idea is, if you consider that you have an Hamiltonian H and you know nothing about it, except that its matrix elements have some typical size of variance sigma, then you can take them to be simply independently distributed random variables. So you take each matrix element to be random variables, and you obtain then the celebrated Gaussian unitary ensemble or Gaussian orthogonal ensemble, which correspond to take just a random Hermitian matrix or random real symmetric matrix. And there is a lot of universality coming out in those experiments. For instance, it is known that the distribution of the eigenvalue in the GUE ensemble is universal, in the sense that the density of eigenvalues takes the form of just of a semicircle. It has a finite extent, and the density is maximal in the middle here. It's a minimum on the boundary of the circle, and it takes a semicircle law. It's also known that the statistics of the spacing between eigenvalues is universal for large matrices, but I won't discuss that here. And random matrices has been much used in many, many condensed matter contexts, for instance, by Melo, Pereira, and Kumar in 85. And there are many, many, many papers using random matrices in the context of studying the properties of some quantum mechanical system or the quantum transport in mesoscopic system, etc. Okay? So now the properties of a large matrices is that the correlation between the element of the matrices can be described by planar Feynman graphs. You know, if you consider a random Hermitian matrices, and if you are considering what is the correlation between two elements of the matrices, these are matrix elements, they are just given by a delta function, delta, so it's non-zero if A equals C and B equals B, and you can represent this by a propagator. So the propagator carries the indices for the matrix, first matrix AB, and carry them up to the indices of the matrix CD. And those two lines represent just the fact that the index A has to be equal to the index D, and the index B has to be equal to the index C. So it's a propagator exactly like in any quantum field theory, except that it's in fact a ribbon. It's a flat planar. And if you are now considering what is, for instance, the expectation value of the trace, or the average of the trace of a power of H, In general, you have many, many, many correlations. But when the size of the matrix becomes large, only planar diagrams survive. And this leads to a lot of simplification. In particular, this leads to way to compute very easily those things. And one important property of random matrices is that there is self-averaging. Namely, it means that, in fact, if you are interested for a given random matrices to the typical properties of matrix element of a random matrix, you can just take one element of the random matrix and average over all the possible matrices which occur in your ensemble. So it's a property which is known in statistical mechanics as self-averaging. Okay? And so what shall we do? We shall consider a system where the system S is a spin, the system E is a very large quantum system, and the Hamiltonian is composed of three terms, as everywhere. There is this term which describes the dynamics of the spin. There is this term which describes the dynamics of the external system. And there is this Hamiltonian, interaction Hamiltonian, which describes the interaction between the spin and the external system. And if we make no assumption about what is the kind of Hamiltonian we have, except that in some sense, for instance, these large spins emerge from the collective state of a collection of a large number of small quantum spins, like in a magnetic nanoparticles. In fact, you start from an Hamiltonian which describes at the microscopic level the interaction between each spin and the external system, and you end up by taking some kind of generic Hamiltonian, coupling the spin to an external system. And if you consider that you have generic interaction and you have a large number, any value of the spin going from g equal 1/2 to g equal infinity, I will introduce a model which describes this kind of model where the interaction here is generic. This is a spin. And I assume just that this is a generic Hamiltonian. And I will see that in that way, we can generalize model which has been much studied in the case of the spin 1/2 or the two-level system. In particular, here are some of the basic references, but there are many, 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 many references and also comparison with some experiments for the two-level quantum system. Okay. So the first question I want to ask is, what are the invariants of a generic Gaussian random interaction H, where the interaction describes the interaction between a spin G and an external system with a large number of states. So I assume that I know nothing about the interaction except that this Hamiltonian, you know, acts on the Hilbert space of the system, which is the Hilbert space of the spin G, and times the Hilbert space of the external system. So the states are labeled by the magnetic indices R, which come from minus G to G, and the source index A, which describes the states of the external system. So I'm looking for a random Hamiltonian, so a matrix acting on this large Hilbert space. And I assume that the distribution is Gaussian. So the Hamiltonian obeys to a Gaussian statistic. And simply, the distribution of the Hamiltonian is invariant under the action of this rotation group SU2 and on the action of the permutation, if you want, of any unitary transformation acting on this big system. Okay? So it's just a generalization of the problem of defining what are random Hamiltonian acting on an n-dimensional spin system. And if I do that, in fact, it is quite simple to solve the problem because you realize that the interaction Hamiltonian, in fact, it's a matrix, but it belongs to a large Hilbert space, which is the tensor products of the tensor products of C2G plus 1 times T plus 1. So this is a tensor product of the spin G representation of the spin times the spin G representation of the spin times the tensor products of Cn by Tn, namely the space of matrices, n by n dimensional matrices over C. Okay? And so the SU2 groups act on this part of the Hamiltonian, and the UN group acts on this part. But If you think about this as some representation of SU2, it is well known that the scalar, the tensor products of two-spin representation here is given just by the sum of all spin representation from 0 to 2G. It's just the rules, the standard rule of addition of angular momentum. And this means that, in fact, you can decompose the part, you know, here is a matrix element of the Hamiltonian. Here are the spin indices, and you can use the Wigner representation of operator, and instead of considering the basis of the Hamiltonian in the spin states, you can go to a representation in terms of L, the number that indexes this spin, and M, the magnetic. So those are the indices for each vector in each representation. You get a simple transform, linear transform using the 3G symbols. And you realize very quickly, doing a little bit of group theory, is that it is those H, A, B, L, M, which has to be considered as random Gaussian independently distributed variables. So instead of having those to be Gaussian independent variables, it is those objects which have to be taken as Gaussian independent random variables. If you want that the distribution of the random Hamiltonian you are chosen is invariant under the action of this big group acting on this big state of all possible matrices. Okay? And then, in order for this distribution to be invariant, you just have to assume that the variance, so the variance of those H, A, B, L, M can be different, but simply it has only to depend on the index L, the angular momentum, which labels the representation. So delta can be big for L equals 0, 1 for L equals 1, and 0 for 2G, for instance. Okay. So you have now a set of, you have a distribution which is characterized not by a single variance, but by the set of the 2G plus 1 variances in all the possible spins of the model. Okay? And if you are using this new, what's called Gaussian U2 times UN ensemble, if you are interested in what are the correlation between any general matrix element of the Hamiltonian, it's a random Hamiltonian, then you find that with respect to the indices which labels the UN part, it's just the delta A, D, delta B, gamma of the standard Gaussian unitary ensemble matrix. But it contains a spin part, which is highly non-trivial because it's a function of the variance and some combination of the 6G symbol, of the 3G symbols, with just some kind of group theory which gives you this rhythm. So we have the correlation between two elements of the Hamiltonians, our standard ribbon propagator for the indices which label the states of the external systems, but you have a more complicated structure for the spin indices, which contain the fact that we have group theory associated to the SU2 invariance of the distribution. Okay. But this is just a formula, and you can use it. And you can view it as a non-trivial generalization of some very already known random matrix ensembles, which are called random bond matrices, but I won't elaborate on that. So it's some kind of non-trivial, non-abelian generalization of random bond matrices. Okay. So once we have done that, of course, we are interested in the dynamics of the system. So we are interested in the dynamics of the system. So I will make two strong assumptions. First, I assume that the spin has no dynamics in its sound, so I can set HS to 0. This means that, in fact, I won't be able to observe any dissipation or thermalization effect. I am only interested in the decoherence of the system. Okay? Now, I will also assume that the dynamics of the external system is as random as the dynamics of the interaction term. So I take a random Hamiltonian, H, E, also. So I take a random Hamiltonian for H, the interaction Hamiltonian between the spin and the external system. And I take a random Hamiltonian for the external system also, which means that it's H, E, if you want. It's just the L equals 0 part of the random Hamiltonian. And then, once we have this model, so we take
random Hamiltonian for the external part, a random Hamiltonian for the coupling between the spin and the external system, and no Hamiltonian, so trivial dynamics for the spin. Then, of course, what we are left with computing what is called as the evolution functional. So if I start from a separable state where the spin is in a state psi, and the external system is at a state phi, then from the evolution, the whole big system is in a capital phi state, and the reduced density metric for the spin is obtained, as usual, by taking the trace with respect to the environment of the density metrics of the pure state of the whole system. And once you compute that, if you know the density metrics of the spin at time zero, the density metrics of the spin at time t is given by a linear, completely positive map on the space of density metrics. So you have a super operator m of t, where m of t is given by a formula like that. And in fact, it's an operator which is acting on the space of density metrics. And simply, this is an highly non-trivial object because, in general, we have a complicated dynamics and it cannot have any form of a Lindbladian operator. So the idea, remember, H is a random Hamiltonian. So you take it at random in some definite ensemble of random matrices. Okay? So this M is a functional of the Hamiltonian we started from. And the idea is that the typical properties of the evolution of the operator for a random Hamiltonian is well described, assuming self-averaging. If you compute this super operator evolution functional M and take its average with respect to all the possible Hamiltonian you are considering. You see, you compute an Hamiltonian, an operator depending on Hamiltonian, and then so you take the average. What is that? Oh, I know, I think it's something. Okay, someone is calling me. I thought I'd switch. Okay. And of course, this will be valid below the Heisenberg term time of the whole system, but it's of order 1 over n, and n is taken to be large, so we can neglect any recurrence effect in this subject. Okay? So once you do that, of course, you have to compute using the rules of given by random metric theory for the whole system. So in fact, you can show that if you are interested in computing this super operator M, in fact, what you have to compute are, as intermediate object, are resolvent object which are defined. So the usual resolvent, you know, you have this big Hamiltonian H which describes the whole system. You describe the resolvent as the inverse operator 1 over some x. X is just a complex number minus H. But you take the trace with respect to the external system. So you get, now this is an operator acting on the Hilbert space of the spin. Okay? Now, you can take a level two resolvent when if you take the scalar products, you take the tensor products of two resolvents. So this is now, this big thing is an operator acting on the space of density matrices of the whole system. And then you take the reduced trace with respect to the environment of this object, then you get an operator acting on the space of all density matrices of the spin system, which depend on two numbers, x and y. And for some reason, if you know this operator, you will be able to compute the super evolution operator M. And these objects are convenient to study because, in fact, they are solutions of recursion relation. These objects are given by sum of diagrams. If you apply the rule of perturbation theory, you know that a large n non-planar diagrams are disconnected. So here are the diagram which occurs when you compute this operator. Here are the diagram which compute when you compute this operator. And remember, this is a tensor, so it's an operator acting on the Hilbert space, so it carries two spin indices. And this is an operator acting on the space of density matrices, so it carries four operators, four indices, R, S, and T, and U. But you have the fact that this is given by a sum of planar diagrams means that you can express any diagram like that as a sum of subdiagrams where you choose one line and you separate what is outside and what is inside the line you have chosen from the beginning. You can play the same kind of game for this operator, and it provides you an algebraic way to compute those objects. So if you know the propagator, and this propagator represents this complicated function I showed you before, this complicated correlator, you know how to compute these objects. So I won't give any technical detail, but I will just state what is the final result. The final result is very simple, in fact. The final result is that the evolution functional, you know, remember, the evolution functional acts on the space of density matrices of the spin system. It's a complicated evolution functional. But when I computed it for my model, if instead of considering the matrix representation of the density matrix, I consider its Wigner representation by expressing it in terms of indices L and M by the formula I gave before for the Hamiltonian, but you can apply it for the density matrix as well, you realize that the evolution is just diagonal in L and M. Namely, if you start at time zero by a density matrix rho of zero, you take its Wigner representation. So you have a set of W of L, M of zero. You realize that the W, L, M at time t is just the function of the W, L, M at time zero. So you have no mixing between the L and the M. And so it's a linear function. So it's just the multiplication by a function. This function M hat depends both on t, it depends on the index L, and because of spin SU2 invariance, it cannot depend on M, so it depends only on M, on L. So you have simply to compute a set of functions which depend on time and on the spin index L going from 0 to 2g, the total two times the total spin of your system. Okay? Of course, this kernel M hat of L, M, M will depend both of time, both of some spin number L, and it depends on the rule distribution of the variance of the Hamiltonian. It depends in the complicated way of which matrix random Hamiltonian ensemble you started from. Okay, so it depends on a large number of variance delta. Okay? But it depends simply through a very simple function. It depends on this distribution simply through some typical time tau naught. So it's a function of the time divided by some time scale tau naught, and through a function of L, Z of L, and Z of L, both the function Z of L, the parameter Z of L, and the time scale tau naught, in fact, depend on this object delta hat of L, which is a linear combination of the original variance with some sig g symbol. So it's obtained by doing some group theory. And once you have done that, in fact, that's the technical part of the talk. Then after that, I won't be any techniques. The problem is just decomposed in two parts for my model. First, there is an SU2 group theory part, which amounts to compute this function delta hat of L. And once you have that, all the quantum dynamics is contained in a function, which is a function M of time and of this function Z, Z, where Z is a parameter, which is just a ratio between delta hat of L and delta hat of zero, which is the inverse of the square of this time tau naught here. Okay? And here is the typical value. So you have to compute this function. It is given by a complicated formula. But this function, you know, here is a function. The function, so we have a function M, which depends both on time and of a parameter Z, which contains information about the spin we are considering and on all the dynamics, or the original dynamics of the system. So we are at some Z somewhere here. But what's important to see is that this function M, it starts from 1 here, it decays very quickly, which means that you have a disappearance of many of the quantum correlation of your system, except if the parameter Z is very close to 1, And if Z is very close to 1, the evolution is very, very, very slow. You see? Okay, so, and once you have done that, it's very easy to, if you have computed this function, it's very easy to visualize the dynamics of the density matrix for any choice of Hamiltonian and any choice of initial state for your spin, because you can represent the state of the spin simply using the Wigner distribution function or the quasi-probability distribution on the sphere. Remember, we know how the WLM evolves with time through the previous equation. And if you multiply those W, if you take a function on the sphere, unit sphere, given by the combination of the spherical harmonics with this function W of M, we get a function of the function defined on the two-dimensional sphere and our unit vector, which evolves with time and which represent the density, the evolution of the density matrix of the spin system. So here are the definition. And what it is particularly interesting to consider what the so-called coherent state, evolution of coherent state. So I presume most of you know what the coherent state are. It's just a generalization of what the coherent state are for instance, the harmonic oscillator. And those are the states, in fact, which maximize the knowledge what you have on the spin. So basically, a coherent state is a quantum version of a classical state where the spin points in only one direction, well-defined direction. And coherent state are, if you want, maximally classical state of the spin, while for instance, random states will look very, very different. So now let me give you an example of application of the kind of calculation I've been doing. Okay. First, here is the Wigner transform of a random state. You take a random state for your Hamiltonian, you see, and you consider what is the Wigner distribution, the quasi-probability distribution, which represents this random state on the sphere. So instead of representing the sphere, I take a stereographic projection of the sphere. So if here is a plane, which is just the projection, you know, what the stereographic projection is that instead of having a sphere like that, you project it, the sphere. So any point on the sphere here, S, is projected. This is the North Pole, this is the South Pole, and this is the S prime, the projection. So here I have a plane. I have a plane. The North Pole is here, and the South Pole is at infinity. But the equator is somewhere. The equator is just somewhere here. And so here is the representation of the function. This is the value of the function as a function of the two coordinates on the sphere. And if I take a random state, spin state, and I consider what is the Wigner distribution, I take a very, 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 very random state. So this is a typical quantum state, looks like a very, very disorganized function on the sphere. Okay? Now, let us consider that you start from an initial random state, and let us see what's happened when it evolves. Okay? So, now I let this state and I let it evolve with time, and you see something very, okay? You see that as a function of time, very quickly, all the fluctuation disappear, and you get a Wigner distribution. I don't know if it's very clearly written here. You get just a flat function, a function which is constant on the sphere. So a function which is constant on the sphere means that the density distribution is just proportional to the identity. The density matrix is proportional to the identity, which means that the pure state, the pure random spin state, becomes maximally entangled with the external system. And therefore, the density matrix is just tells you that you have no information at all. So it can be, it's just a statistical mixture of all the possible states for the spin. So you have lost any information on the spin through this procedure. Okay? So that's the solution of the model. But now let us do that, the same thing for a coherent state. So I consider a coherent state where the spin points in the up direction, so it goes on the north people. Okay, and so the corresponding Wigner distribution is just like a very peaked Gaussian centered at the origin. So it really looks like if the spin points just in one direction. So that's the Wigner distribution of a coherent state. And let us this spin evolves. If you do that using the solution given by the model, you see that something happened to the spin, but it evolves. In some sense, it starts to be a bit wider, wider, wider. But you see the dynamics is much, much, much longer than what was happening to the random state. So the behavior of the evolution of the spin when it's coupled to this random environment, through this random Hamiltonian to an environment or an external system, is very different when you have a quantum spin, a coherent state, and a random state. Okay? And now you can play. Since I have an exact solution, I can consider a quantum superposition of two coherent states. So I have a state which is up, and I have a state which is down. So this is like a Schrödinger's cat state, a superposition of two orthogonal state, different state of your system. So if you look at the Wigner transform, it's some textbook analysis, you see also this sharp peak represent the up term, this sharp peak represent the other state, and those oscillations in the Wigner transform just represent the fact that they are coherent. This state is just a random superposition. It's a coherent superposition of those two. So since there are quantum correlation between those two states, because this is a pure state, which is a superposition of these states and these states, you see it very clearly on the Wigner transform because you have very strong oscillation of the Wigner distribution. You see? Okay? And now let us look how the system evolves. You see that the oscillation are disappearing very quickly, while the coherent peaks start to evolve, but much, much more slowly. And in fact, what is happening is that the coherent oscillation you disappear almost as fast as what was happening for the random state, while the peaks here evolve as slowly as what was happening for a coherent state. So you have two different typical time scales. Okay? And you can play with that. You can do, you can play, since I have an exact solution, you can take a spin which is in a superposition of three coherent states. If you want, if you think about it in terms of a Schrödinger cat, you have a state which represents the fact that the cat is alive and awake. Here, the cat is alive but sleeping, and here the cat is dead. And of course, in some sense, a quantum state where the cat is awake is different from the quantum state where the cat is asleep, but they are much closer than the state where the cat is dead. Okay, and in fact, on the sphere, these states and these states have an angle of pi over 2, while these states and these states has an angle which is larger. So you see, these peaks represent this state. This peak represents these states, and this peak represents these states. And now you have, you know, you have those oscillations which are in between those two states, in between those two states, and those oscillations are in between those two states, and they just represent the fact that you have a quantum superposition of three states. This one is has quantum correlation with this one, it has quantum correlation with this one, and it has quantum correlation with this one. You see? So yes?
Are they orthogonal?
They are almost orthogonal. Mm-hmm. The states up and the states down are really orthogonal. These states and these states are not really completely orthogonal, but they are orthogonal up to factor of order 1 over the spin, and we are considering a very large spin. For instance, here the spin is 20. So it's already something very large. And if you go to a spin which is 100 or 1,000, they are nearly orthogonal. So it's a very good approximation of having an orthogonal. And you can play a little bit with the coefficients so that they really become orthogonal. So in some sense, it's just technical. It's a point which is technical. Okay. And let them evolve. We play the same game. So you see that the quantum correlation disappear on this movie. And if you are, let me show it a little bit more, once more, you can almost get persuaded that the quantum correlation between these states and these states, or between these states and these states, disappear more quickly than between these states and these states. So the closer two states are, the longer the quantum correlation disappears. So it's something which is not unexpected, but we have a nice derivation of that. Now, one last thing I want to show you is that I will go back to the cat state and look at what happens to the correlation. You see, you have oscillations. Those very strong interference terms, they oscillate. They disappear, they reappear, they disappear, they reappear. And it's a very strong signal that the dynamics of disappearance of those correlations is non-Markovian. Because if it was Markovian, it would just be an exponential decay. So it means that the dynamics of this quantum system is non-trivial because it contains strong memory, time memory effect. It's not at all given by an evolution equation, which would be a master equation local in time. Okay? So now if you think a little bit more, if you study more what I've been doing here, you realize that you have, in fact, four typical time scale in the dynamic of the spin in my model. Okay? That I have called tau 0, tau 1, tau 2, tau 3. What are those three scales? This comes out from the exact solution that I have not written. First, you have a first small time scale, which is typically the dynamical time scale for irreversibility of the spin dynamics. So you have a spin. It starts to be coupled with an external system. And for some times, you know, the evolution is almost like a unitary evolution, so you can reverse it. You can let the system be coupled to the spin, and you expect that by some way you can go back the spin. So the dynamics is reversible in some sense. But after a time t naught, the dynamics will become really irreversible. And this time scale, tau 0, is just the inverse, in fact, of what is called the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of the Wool Hamiltonian of the system. So basically, it's 1 over the typical size of the eigenvalues of the system. Okay. Now, you have a second time scale, which is larger, which is the time it takes for a generic state to decay into a completely homogeneous state. So it's the time by which, in the first movie I showed, all the oscillation of the associated to the Wigner distribution of your pure stem disappear. So it's a typical timescale evolution for generic quantum states, which contains a component in the momentum which are very, very large of order the total spin, but not of square root of g. Okay. And the ratio between the first time, which is the smallest, and the second time, which is the evolution or decoherence time scale for generic random scale, random states of my spin, is given by ratio, is given by the square of the ratio of the norm of the interaction Hamiltonian over the norm of the ratio of the total Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian, the interaction Hamiltonian between the spin and the external system, and this is the Hamiltonian for the spin system. So you see that this ratio is obviously smaller than 1. So tau 1 is larger than tau 2. But depending on the respective size of the matrix element of the Hamiltonian for the external systems compared to the typical size of the matrix element of the interaction Hamiltonian, tau 1 can be of the same order than tau 0 or much larger than tau 0. Yes?
In your town knot, it looks like it's finite even if there's no interaction between the two systems.
Pardon?
The town knot formula.
Yes.
It looks finite even when there's no interaction. If H sub S E is zero.
Yes, you are right. So, okay, so the, I think the definition is a bit oversimplified here. There is in between, there is somewhere here. Yeah, it's a, there is a bit of an oversimplification. But typically, I would say for generic small interaction, it's still valid. But I agree, yes. Yeah, I should look back in my in the paper for the exact definition. It's typically that, but it's slightly more complicated. Yes?
No, we're just going to say that you made this assumption that H of environment has the same, like, I mean, it's of the same order as H of system and environment. So
yes.
If you take one of them zero, then the other one would be of the order of zero. You already made that assumption.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I've made the assumption that all those Hamiltons are typically random. So.
No, I just was saying
no.
That.
Answer. He's suggesting the answer to the question.
Ah, I'm
you
sorry,
already,
I didn't.
Well, I mean, since you already made the assumption that those two Hamiltonian, they have the same order.
Yes.
And,
yes.
So if one of them is zero, then the other one would be
yeah.
the same order.
Yeah, I think you can say that. Okay. Okay. So, okay. So then you have a third time, which is the time scale for which characterizes the dynamics of coherent state, and I will discuss that a bit later. You have seen that, we have seen that the coherent state stays for much longer, but at some point it becomes wider and wider. So it means that the coherent state, in fact, stays pure coherent state for some time, tau 2, and beyond that time, they become also mixed state. They start to be a statistical mixture of pure states. And we shall discuss that later. And finally, there is a third state, a third time, which is a time where everything becomes average over the whole sphere, which is not very interesting. So let me discuss, in fact, what's happening to the coherent state, because the coherent state are the interesting states, because those are the states which look like the quantum classical states in our model. Okay. So the coherent states are stable up and stay pure, therefore, for some time tau 2. And the time tau 2 is defined in terms of the distribution of the delta. But finally, the ratio between the typical time scale for the typical random states and the typical evolution time for coherent state, it is given by a ratio of the square of a ratio of the norm of two operators. Here you have the commutator between the spin operator and the interaction Hamiltonian. And here you have the norm of the spin operator, which is simply the total spin. And here the norm of the interaction operator. And you see from such a formula, which comes out from an exact solution, there are no approximation in this formula. So it's valid for any kind of interaction we have in our model. The ratio between tau 2 and tau 1 is large, so tau 2 is much larger than tau 1. If the commutator between the spin and the interaction is small compared to the products of those two operators. So you see that, in fact, you recover something which is much expected and known in some other cases, is that the coherent states are really robust against decoherence. And so they play the role of either what is called pointer states in decoherence theory and measurement theory, or long-lived semi-classical state, provided that the interaction Hamiltonian, in fact, almost commutes with the spin operator, which is something you expect. You know, if the interaction Hamiltonian doesn't commute at all with the spin, it's clear that the states which represent spin eigenvectors, spin eigenstates of the spin operator, would be very quickly destroyed by the dynamics. But here we recover an explicit results which show that this is indeed the case for a model that we can solve exactly.
And this happens in particular, in fact, in the interaction occurs only in channels of spin which are not too large with compared to the total spin. Okay? So although the dynamics of decoherence depends on the fine details of the Hamiltonian, which is given by the variance we characterize the ensemble, in fact, we get some kind of generic results which are valid for any kind of all Hamiltonian ensembles, you see, by that kind of model. So it illustrates very nicely, I think, the idea which are beyond decoherence and the idea that you may have or may not have long-lived semi-classical state in a model which is completely exactly solvable and in a model where there are no approximation made on the dynamics once you know the Hamiltonian. Okay? So finally, let us look at what's happening to the coherent state. So we have seen that for a time t which is smaller than tau 2, only the pure coherent state survives. And if you have a linear superposition of two coherent states, the quantum correlation disappears and you get just a statistical mixture of two coherent states. Once you have done that, beyond that time, the coherent state becomes a mixture of coherent state. So it looks like some kind of quantum diffusion effects. You know, you still have an interaction between the external system and the coherent states, which moves the pure states. And so the pure states start to move on the sphere, on the phase space of your system. So you say, OK, that it's just a phenomenon of diffusion like in classical physics. You have a state, say it is in contact with a large bath, which so it has some Brownian motion. That's what you would expect. But if you do that, in fact, you realize that it's almost the case because the width of the distribution in phase space grow like the square root of time, which is what you expect if you had a random walk. But if you look at the probability profile of the peak, you have a peak which was a peak associated, which was a Gaussian associated to a random walk, but for a large time, for a time which is larger than tau 2, it doesn't become a Gaussian. It would be a Gaussian for a classical diffusion, but there is some small but quite definite difference in the quantum case, which signals that it's not a stochastic Markovian process. It's a diffusion which still has quantum memory effects, even at large time. So there is a memory of the fact that the process was quantum and that it was not Markovian, even at large time, which is a slightly non-trivial effect. So I've done that you can solve the model, and that's an extension of the model, where you assume that the dynamics HE for the external system is, in fact, not a generic dynamics, but you can find any dynamic. So you can change the eigenvalue distribution of the external Hamiltonian from a Wigner semicircle law to any law that you choose. And you can also, those results were given when I was taking a random initial state for the external system, but you can choose an initial state which is well-defined. And then this picture will illustrate what I will be discussing later. So you expect that the dynamics will become Markovian if the ratio between T0 and T1 is small. And in that case, this means that if you look at what are the eigenvalue distribution of the spectrum of the interaction Hamiltonian, in fact, if T0 is smaller than T1, this spectrum is much more shallow than this one. And if I do that, you can ask, what are the conditions for having a Markovian dynamics and a classical diffusion? And the answer is that you get a fast dynamics and a classical diffusion if tau1 is much larger than tau2, which means that the Hamiltonian is much larger, the Hamiltonian of the external system is much larger than the Hamiltonian of the interaction between the spin system. But in addition, the initial state for the external system has to be an energy eigenstate for the external system. And in that case, the diffusion of your points on the on your coherent state on the phase space, in fact, becomes a Markovian diffusion. So they become a Brownian walk with a diffusion coefficient, which is in fact given by something who looks very much like a Fermi golden rule formula. You have a 2 pi. You have a number which is the density of the state of the external system at the energy E you start from for the as an initial state for the external system. And then you have a coefficient which is typically the modulus square of the typical size of matrix element of the commutator between S, the spin operator, and the interaction Hamiltonian. You see? So the commutator between the spin and the interaction Hamiltonian comes again in this formula and drives the process of diffusion of coherent state in the regime where only the coherent state, the stable semi-classical state, have survived. You see? So you get a nice picture and the feature of how you go from purely deterministic quantum dynamics up to some kind of random classical dynamics, which emerges from the interaction between the spin and the external system. So you get a nice explanation in that model, description of the transition between the quantum dynamics and the random classical dynamics induced by the coupling. And I won't have time to discuss this, but I will finish by explaining that this kind of model, which here was a kind of toy model, in fact, leads to interesting ongoing problems. First, I have not taken into account the dynamics of the spin, but if you assume, for instance, that the spin is coupled to external magnetic field, so you have a big spin which presses, which has a Larmor precession, and if it's coupled to an external system, you expect that you have will have dissipation, relaxation to the lowest energy state. And in the case where the process is non-Markovian, it's a difficult problem to solve the model exactly, but it should lead to interesting effect. Then it would be very interesting, I think, to generalize a very simple model where I have a model, a matrix ensemble, which is invariance under the SU2 group for the spin and the UN group for which says basically that all the states of my external system are equivalent for the dynamics, to more complicated system, for instance, to have a finite energy range interaction. The interaction shouldn't change too much the energy of the external system, which consists in treating some kind of mixture of my model and of bound random matrix models. Another interesting point will be to compute the correlation at several times between the evolution. So, you know, if you have an open quantum system, in fact, the evolution function of M of t tells you what are the correlation between the density matrix at time zero and the density matrix at time t. So this will give you, for instance, how, if you consider the evolution of some operator at time t, how it evolves with t. You may be interested in computing what are the quantum correlation between, in your system, between operators at time t1, at time t2, et cetera. And for that, it's not sufficient to have the evolution operator, the evolution functional at time t, you get some kind of generalization of m at time t1, t2, etc., which are much more difficult to compute. And the interesting case is to compute, you expect non-trivial effect when the dynamics is non-Markovian. Because you may expect non-trivial time correlation between what's happening at time equals zero, at time t1, at time t2, etc. So there are interesting mathematical problems and physical problems associated to that. Okay, and there is also some interesting planar algebraic structure when you start to study the equation associated to those generalization of the evolution functional. I would like also to generalize the theory of random matrix models that I've been considering to generalization of, in some sense, of generalizing the SU2 cross UN to a matrix ensemble where you have a random matrices acting on a space which is the tensor product of some representation of spin G of the SU2 group and some representation R of some group G, which is something more complicated than just the fundamental representation of the group UN. Okay? And this, in fact, is a problem which is not only mathematically interesting and difficult, but which should lead to physical application, because if you are interested in model where the quantum spin G is large, but is not just given by a given quantum spin you put in your model from the beginning, but you assume that it's a spin which emerged for the interaction on many small quantum spin, like you consider a cluster of quantum spin which interacts, which built a large spin, you have to consider what are the internal degrees of freedom of this cluster of spin. They will model the environment, and you have to consider what are the what is the group of symmetries which remains in a big cluster of spin, and you have to consider this model and so such a model. So such question, which seems like a mathematical question of just defining some fancy random matrix model which has not been studied before, in fact, is related to understanding what's happening in more realistic model of spin interacting with either environment or just cluster of quantum spin. So they may be also interesting for making models of measurement apparatus, so making a physical model of a measurement apparatus which interacts with small quantum systems and which has pointer states. So this should lead to progresses in this theory. And so I hope that I will show that this kind of model is interesting, and I thank you for your attention.
Yes?
So there's another class of models that people often use to study this kind of decoherence. Which,
yes.
For example, one well-known example is the Caldera-Leggett
yes.
model. In that case, it's also useful to express it in a kind of path integral language.
Yes.
In terms of pairs of paths and kind of, and the non-Markovian
yes.
character comes out in a kind of non-local interaction between
yes.
The two halves of the pairs. Do you have a path integral?
Yeah, the Caldera-Leggett model is a model where you don't have spin, but you have a bunch of harmonic oscillators.
Right.
So the model in that case is in some sense much easier to study because it's always a Gaussian model.
Right.
So the path integral model method works quite well. Here, the model is non-trivial because we have spins which are not, you cannot modelize them by just by Gaussian path integral. It's possible to do that, but it's more complicated.
Yeah, so you didn't try
yeah.
to do a sort of path integral. Version.
No.
It'd be interesting
no.
to see. What
and also in the model, like in the Caldera-Leggett model, the interaction is not modelized by a random matrix. So in some sense, the Caldera-Leggett-like model are one class of model which can be solved. The random matrix, the model where the interaction is modelized by a random matrix are another class, but the interaction is not so large. And I have chosen to have a random matrix model. In fact, my initial motivation when you take clusters of quantum spins, you really, from the very beginning, are led to the idea that the interaction can be modelized by a random matrix. So I had some physical motivation that I'm not able to justify yet because I don't have a solution for those models, but this is the reason why I've been studying random matrix model Hamiltonian and not simpler model like the Caldera-Leggett model. If you want, the external system or the environment is of a different nature.
Yes. this so that correlations not just decay but oscillate. Do they pass zero or do they oscillate above the zero all the time?
Do they
oscillate so zero or just above zero?
Oh, you mean in the Wigner?
In your model, in toy model you show.
Yes. What do you mean by that? You want them to oscillate below zero?
Do they cross zero at some particular time, or just do they oscillate?
Yes. But in fact, already in the original, let me go back to the original picture. I went a bit too far. Yeah, okay. In fact, what you picture is too light. But if you look at that, in fact, you have oscillations, for instance, which are the oscillations which are associated to the fact that you have quantum correlation between those two quantum states. This is positive, this is negative, this is positive, this is negative. So, in fact, you are seeing only the positive part, but it's almost as positive as it is negative. I might show, I have kept a three-dimensional picture, turn it to you. No. So in fact, these are really oscillations which goes to minus, to plus to minus. No. So the Wigner distribution is not positive.
It's more interesting whether all of them are zero at once or no. Or could they be zero and then again become non-zero?
What you see here is that, in fact, they become indeed, all of them becomes very, almost zero. And then I should find a way to slow down. But you see, they all become zero at the same time, then they reappear. So they kind of disappearance, then reemergence of correlation, then the reappearance, then reemergence. So it's some kind of echo, if you want. It's some kind of echo effect, co-effect. Except that it's not a perfect echo, so there is some echo, but finally the echo decays to zero. You see?
How should we explain that we had at some particular moment the system without correlation, and then this just appear again?
Well, it comes from the solution. It comes from the property of this. The function. So I have no real physical explanation. It depends very much on the choice of parameters you choose. This phenomenon occurs for some distribution of random matrix distribution, and sometimes it doesn't appear. You see, basically, it comes from the fact that this universal function M of T of Z, you see, that in some regimes it has oscillation, and in some regime it doesn't have oscillations. And if you have chosen your delta, the distribution of variance, so the statistics of your random Hamiltonian, in such a way that you are in this regime for what you are interested in here, you will see oscillations. And if you are if you are in this regime, you will not see oscillation. So you see, it's not a universal phenomenon. It may occur. Nothing forbids it to have oscillation, but it depends very much on the ensemble you have chosen for your random Hamiltonians. Does it answer your question?
Yes, thank
you. Okay. So it's not something really universal, but still, there is you can see there is some kind of typical time which should come out from the model, but I don't remember at that time what. I should, I think, be able to show.
Maybe we should stop there.
Francois
is around for another week.
Still another 1 week and a half.
1 week and a half. And also there will be a chance to talk to him downstairs where there will be some free snacks. So let's thank
Okay.